I'm Marty Moscow, and welcome to Radio Times. Philadelphia Mayor-elect Jim Kenney announced on Friday that prisoner reentry programs will be among his administration's top priorities. He said that the city could be an employer, as could companies working with the city to give people a second chance. Last week, President Obama announced Ban the Box legislation for ex-offenders applying for government jobs and subsidized housing. This has coincided with the Justice Department's release of thousands of federal prisoners who had been incarcerated for drug offenses. Today, we want to focus on reentry programs that reduce the recidivism rate and work to prevent crime in the first place. Joining us here in our Philadelphia studio is Brandon T. Jones. He's founder and executive director of the New Generation Foundation. That's a community group here in Philadelphia that seeks to reduce violence, particularly among young people. He was recognized by the Knight Foundation, awarded a Black Male Engagement Award. And in 2005, he was sentenced to prison for attempted murder. He is with us here in our Philadelphia studio. And Brandon Jones, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you, Marty. How you doing? Good morning.
Good morning. Do you think there's a changed view? And I've summarized in my introduction what Jim Kenney's been talking about, what the president has been talking about, what the Justice Department is doing. Do you think we're at a point where we're beginning as a country to rethink our criminal justice system?
Yes. I mean, personally, I do. You know, being, you know, from, you know, that background and coming through, you know, the criminal justice system. And now being an advocate kind of on the other side and just seeing, you know, some of the holes and gaps and different opportunities that are arising, you know, it's definitely safe to say that, you know, America is looking at, you know, in a different lens, a more, not, I wouldn't say a more laid back lens,
right,
but definitely a more, you know, a lens where it's like we need to do something now.
And looking at, I guess, some of the consequences of getting tough on crime,
oh, yes,
the numbers, especially as it has affected African-American men.
Oh, yes. Yes. Men of color definitely have been affected by it. I mean, the recidivism rate, you know, it's just got way out of hand. You know, and now it's to the point where it's like, you know, if we can spend these millions and millions of dollars on keeping folks, you know, housed in, you know, for a lot of these crimes that really don't warrant all of this time that a lot of these people are serving, now it's like the country is wants to answer and wants to try to do something to relieve that.
Let me ask you a little bit about yourself. In 2005, you were sentenced for attempted murder. What happened?
Yes. Well, I was one of the young men where, you know, I come up in a good household, you know, and I didn't have to sell
drugs.
With
a mom and a dad,
yeah,
right?
Mother and a father, yep. My mother, Gary and Victoria Jones, you know, they raised me. They put a lot of, you know, good morals within me, you know, and instilled it on a daily basis. But it was the outside world that I like to gravitate towards, you know. And, you know, they would say that I was two different people in the household. And I noticed this now and even in my mentoring, you know, my journey. And I see a lot of young men, you know, they're one way out of the house and then they're a different way when they're in the home with the family. And what I was outside of my house was just someone who wanted to gravitate towards a lot of those negative things because that was what was exciting or promoted to us on a daily basis.
Is that what it was? It just looked exciting?
Yeah, it looked exciting. But not only that, the life of crime to us growing up, especially here and in certain parts of Philadelphia, was like, if you wasn't doing that or living that kind of lifestyle as a juvenile, then you kind of wasn't in the in crowd. You wasn't cool. Nobody wanted to hang with you. That was kind of how it was in our environments, you know, as opposed to what I learned when I, you know, moved to the suburbs.
Were you arrested as a teenager?
Yes. A couple of times. Not a whole lot, but there were times, definitely, you know.
A couple of times, but not a whole lot.
Not a whole lot, but to me, you know. You know, like stealing cars and just stuff that you know you shouldn't do, you know, as a teenager. You know, we got thrills off of that stuff, and that was stuff that was like, hey, we're accepted by the older, you know, negative guys in the neighborhood. You know, maybe, you know, we can be, you know, something like them. You know, and that's how we identify, you know, the same way as a basketball player that's successful. You say, hey, I want to play basketball. I want to model my career after him and see where I can get, you know, and that's kind of how, you know, the terminology is.
How did your parents deal with that? As you said, you were a different person inside the house.
I mean, my parents, they did everything they could. You know, they saved their extra money to send me to different programs and karate and just, you know, violin and just different things to keep me motivated and learning. But, you know, that wasn't enough.
You weren't interested?
No, it was times, you know, because one thing I noticed, you know, is like my attention span, you know. And now I'm getting older, you know, like, you know, I do karate for 2-3 months and then it's like, I don't want to do it no more. You know how children are. And, you know, but if there's something going on in the streets, I wouldn't tell them about that. This was my activities I was into. And so I could just keep it going as long as I felt like it until they got a call or somebody, you know, pulled me up.
And what happened with this attempted murder?
Well, that was a situation where I was like kind of knee deep in the drug game, you know, at the time.
How old?
I was 18. I had just graduated high school. And that was because I was coming out of a juvenile facility that I was in at the time. And, you know, I got to graduate because of me being there so long and doing my schoolwork. But that just changed my whole view, my family's view, you know, on the criminal justice system. And it changed the way they looked at me and how they dealt with me, you know, as a child, you know, and they had to take some bumps and bruises. And a lot of that was just my doing.
You had a gun?
Yes, I definitely had a gun. I was like a drug deal going bad, basically. So, you know, I was selling like, you know, large sums of marijuana at the time. And that was them moving me out of the city and into the suburbs. And instead of me just going down there to focus on my education and, you know, living in a beautiful neighborhood, a nice house that they struggled to pay for every month, I was just doing the total opposite, you know, not going to school, you know, selling my drugs and just doing what I wanted to do, thinking that the universe owed me something, which it doesn't.
So did you shoot somebody?
Yes, I ended up shooting somebody and that drug deal going bad. And it ended up in a situation where they were trying to rob me. And I just, you know, I just reacted. You know, I was taught in Philly growing up, you don't have no gun or be around a gun if you're not prepared to use it, if your life's in danger. And I felt that that was what it was. And I reacted, you know, prematurely. And, you know, somebody ended up getting hurt behind my actions.
And how did you get a gun?
In the streets of here, Philadelphia. You know, back then, you know, early 90s, you know, late 80s, early 90s, it wasn't hard. You know, it was like getting a pair of sneakers, you know, especially, you know, in the circles
you knew where
that
to
I
go,
ran.
Knew
where
to go.
Knew where to go. And now that's becoming a bigger, so much of a bigger issue outside of, you know, all of the gun rights and different things that we're fighting off here in America.
And I do want to pick up on that. You did go to prison, but it seems like prison turned you around, or perhaps people in a prison.
Yes, yes. How? And you know what I say? And I told Yugi Washington the same thing a couple years ago. I met a pastor. And when I met a pastor there, he was actually a pastor who sold weapons, and he sold weapons to the Defense Department. And this is what he'd done in his business. He was a multimillionaire, but every Wednesday he took the time to come to SCI Camp Hill to mentor to us gentlemen. And he did it. Unless he was sick or on a vacation, he was there. Mm-hmm. And he one day, it just struck me. I guess I was about 3 years into my sentence. And I'm up, you know, I'm in this facility transitioning to go to my home jail. And he said, he came in and he just hit him. He said, hey, I'm going to tell you guys the honest truth. Prison can be a wise man's university or fool's playground.
And that's a direct quote?
A direct quote. And when he hit me, you know, it was Pather Kanothi, his name was. And when he hit me, and I was like, you know, and I just pondered on it for months and months. And then like 9 months went by, and I started to really live on this quote. And it got to a point where I started making prison a university. And I started, it was my actions. You know, my day-to-day and what I was doing in that penitentiary wasn't just a person who was ready to go back out and just sit on a couch and just give up on life. You know, I started taking those necessary steps so I can start rebuilding my life way before I got released.
Do you think it was right time, right place, right person that somehow that penetrated you? Because it seems like you had good parents, you had a good family, people that cared about you.
Yes, ma'am.
But something about the way he said this at that time.
The way he said that, I mean, it just hit a nerve. And it let me know that, hey, Brandon, you're going to die in one of these places if you don't get it together. You're actually going to lose hope. And you're not going to fulfill your God-given destiny. And that was something that I just couldn't live with.
What was it like then once you got out? What, you served about, what, 6 years?
Well, no, it was 4 years, 11 months.
Almost five years. So what was it like for you getting out? And this, in part, is what the show is about.
Oh, I mean, me getting out was a struggle, constant, you know, because it was like, okay, I have all these odds stacked against me, you know. You got, like, the child support issue. That was something. You know, just rebuilding back with my family, that relationship, you know, was very strange. You know, in 5 years, your whole family setting can change. You know, and which mine did. You know, we had a nice, beautiful house in the suburbs. So I come home to my family's divorce. You know, my mom's in one place, my dad's in another. These are my backbone. This is my support system. You know, my siblings, they're, you know, they're separate lives. So everything is like, okay, who do I count on now? And how can I be accountable now? You know, everything's different. You know, so I have to catch up with time, you know, and that kind of gives a person anxiety when you come in and don't have nothing, $2 to your name. Nowhere to live, you know, home plans didn't get approved. So that was why I had to end up staying an extra year or two. You know what I mean? Because the choices that I made early in my sentence. So like all of that stuff gives a person so many thoughts and so many angles to say, you know what, forget it. I'm going to go back to the lifestyle that I used to know, and I'm going to try it this way again.
Feeling that pull of the street.
That pull of gravity.
But somehow you resisted.
Somehow I resisted.
So what is that about? How were you able to do that?
My relationship with God, that's first and foremost. And that's what I encourage every woman, every man, every child, every young person that has to come up with constraints in their life, obstacles that could actually wipe a person out. You know, you have to sit. And I talk a lot about that in my new book that I'm actually getting ready to release. It's just, you know, that you have to center yourself around your central being. And once you figure out what that is for you, the individual, then you have to start working through those obstacles. Like, it's a lot of things now I still struggle with. But when it comes to all that simple stuff, you know, like, you know, how I'm going to eat today, how I'm going to pay, you know, my rent and that stuff. Yeah, it's hard at sometimes. But once you start mastering a foundation for your life, the income and stuff becomes not big of an issue when you start living and moving in the work that God called you to do. You know, and that's what it was for me, that relationship.
Did you believe in God before going in, or did you think about God much?
Well, yes, definitely. You know, because a lot of people, they go to prison, they, you know, they become Muslim or Christian. You know, they look for these kind of scapegoats for that protection and different things like that. But for me, it was just a personal thing. Yes, I believed in God. As my mother and father had me baptized in the church at 8, 9, 10 years old. But that didn't save me. That didn't help me. It was the personal relationship. Mm-hmm. You know, that's what I developed in prison. I didn't have that my whole life growing up, you know. So it was kind of, yeah, I believe in God. Let's go to church on Sunday. And Monday, I'm back being a heathen, you know. And now it's kind of like I got a little constraint on it, a little hold on it, and still slip in areas. But I'm moving in what God called me to do every day.
And we're almost up on a break here. Mm-hmm. I mean, do you feel like you're a less angry person? Were you an angry young man?
Yeah, at times I was. I hid my anger well. Yeah, definitely. Yeah, but now I'm kind of more at ease. You know, I'm 30, and I see so many young people, you know, throughout my travels mentoring, and they're struggling. You know, they're actually angry at life and mad at the wrong people, and I think that we got to rethink that.
As you said, you're 30 years, you're an older, wiser man.
Wiser young man now. Yep. Thank you.
Well, let's take a very short break, and then we'll get back to our conversation. Talking with Brandon T. Jones, he's founder and executive director of the New Generation Foundation, an organization here in Philly helping to reduce violence among young people. He also started something called the Philadelphia International Youth Peace Movement. And joining us in this hour of Radio Times, talking about what it takes to stay out of prison, what happens to young people or ex-offenders when they are released from prison, something that's getting a fair amount of attention from President Obama. Also, Philadelphia Mayor-elect Jim Kinney talking about that as well. We'll take a very short break, get back to our conversation. Lines open at 1-888-477-9499. Send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org, and tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Artie Moscoane talking with Brandon T. Jones a bit about his life, how he ended up in prison, and what he's been doing since his release from prison. And that's the topic for this hour of Radio Times. And again, you can join the conversation at 1-888-477-9499. So help us understand then how you were able to not go back to prison, if I can put it that way. But also, mm-hmm. I know you do a lot of work with young people here in Philadelphia.
Yes, ma'am.
Is it you look at them and you think, you know, they could end up like me?
Yes. That's the main motivation behind me even doing the work that I do. When I came out of prison, mm-hmm. there were not many programs that were geared toward helping somebody like me. You know, wanting to be, you know, this good parent, this good son, this good steward in the community. It just wasn't a lot. And, you know, I went through all of the city ran programs and a lot of stuff really, you know, they gave me a token to get back and forth, but mm-hmm. wasn't that push that I needed. And that's what motivated me to go directly into this work after I started to rebuild, you know, my life.
So what do you say to these young people? And it sounds like it's more about a relationship than giving someone a token so that they can get to a program.
That's right.
But if you see someone and they're making bad decisions, how do you change that?
I mean, well, basically what I do, my thing is just trying to reach the young people on a level that they're on. That's really where it is. I basically just start off by basically asking them, okay, what is it that you're struggling with? What are some of those things that are holding you back from achieving, you know, these goals? And then I start looking at those areas and seeing, okay, if it's the family, then I need to, you know, go in and maybe, you know, let's have a talk with mom. Let's see what's going on with dad, your guardian. But the main thing is just to let's try to get those things out in the open. But I got to do it in a way where it's comfortable for them, because that barrier break down. You know, no child wants to talk to a total stranger about their lifestyle, what's going on in their home, unless they're comfortable with them.
Right.
And that's one thing that I've learned how to make in art, is how to make young people comfortable with these conversations, how to make adults comfortable with these conversations.
And young people want to talk?
Yeah, they
want
to talk.
They want to tell
you
about their lives?
They'll tell you any and everything that they're struggling with if they feel comfortable. And that's part of what I say, reaching them on a level that they're on. You know, arts, culture, entertainment, these are some of the things that we focus on at New Generation.
Do you find that young people are hungry for someone to tell them what to do or someone to care about them?
Yes, young people are definitely hungry. They want to be cared for. They yearn for it. It's like waking up and having breakfast. If a young person goes through their whole day and they don't see no one cares about them or inquires about them, their education, their livelihood, their health, they tend to feel like that no one really cares. You know, folks just have them around for whatever meager reason and not totally invested in their upbringing and their, you know, their resources that they need for their lives.
Are we talking parents here, family?
We're talking parents, school teachers. We're talking community residents, community liaisons, our local politicians. You know, young people looking for leadership. They need something positive to belong to. And if they don't see that in their environment or circumference directly, immediately, not no 90 waiting day lists, you know, for them to get services and things, then they'll go to where they can find it immediately. You know, right now in America, we have this instant gratification, you know, kind of thing going on. And our young people, it's just like, yo, if I can't get it now, if I can't get that message now, if I can't get that picture now, then I don't want to be a part of it. You know, if I can't make that money now, I don't want to be a part of it. I don't want to learn. I don't want to intern. I want it now. And they do whatever that they can do to get that instant gratification. And that's where a lot of the problem is.
And is that where the drug trade is?
Oh, yes, definitely. 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 Especially here in Philadelphia.
Especially in Philadelphia.
Yes, ma'am.
You talked about the fact that as a young man that you were able to get a gun, and you said it's even, what, worse today?
Today, yes.
In terms of just knowing where to go and how to get
just,
it?
Yes, just knowing where to go and how to get it. I mean, I would say it's even worse today. I mean, a young person can get a gun in Philadelphia now faster than they can get, you know, the new LeBron James that come out, you know, because it's easy access to someone who actually has those connections. And those connections now are big brother in the house or my uncle over there, or, you know, the guy that runs the little store down the street, you know, he may have a friend. You know, it's accessible. It's not like a hidden thing. It's not kept away from young people that, hey, you can't get a firearm, you know. And I think that that's wrong. It needs to be some change in that. But it's the mindset of the people.
Interesting. Know? Let me just quickly reintroduce you. That's Brandon Jones, again, founder and executive director of the New Generation Foundation. We're talking about his work with young people here in Philadelphia, also talking about a bit about his own life, where he had some trouble with the law. In fact, ended up serving time in prison for attempted murder. Joining us now by telephone is Jondai Harrell. He's founder and executive director of the Center for Returning Citizens in Philadelphia, and that's an advocacy group for ex-offenders. And he served 18 years for bank robbery. And Jondai Harrell, nice to have you with us on Radio Times.
Yes. Thank you for inviting me.
You're very welcome. And I know you're on your way to the station, so we'll talk in the meantime. I began by talking with Brandon about the fact that there seems to be some change in this country when it comes to things like recidivism and thinking about how we have gotten tough on crime. Do you see a changed attitude, and especially on focusing on people who have gotten out of prison and trying to prevent them from going back into prison?
Well, there is some change. There is some movement. But what we need to do is look at reentry. Look at reentry as how it is practiced now and how it should be. What we basically have now is reentry in the sense of folks who are making resumes, doing job fairs, looking for temporary employment. The focus is on minimum wage jobs, but there's no real accommodations for folks coming out of prison. President Obama recently put into place a mechanism that is going to release 6,000 prisoners.
Right.
But in the city of Philadelphia, we have 2,000 federal prisoners coming home every year. We have over 6,000 state prisoners coming home. We have 7,000 to 10,000 prisoners in the county system that are being recycled through the system. So you're literally talking about 10,000 to 15,000 individuals in any given year returning home to the city of Philadelphia, and this is duplicated across the country. There is nothing in place to deal with these numbers. No real employment programs, no vocational programs. The situations that are in place now cannot accommodate the flood of people, and it's not being practiced in the right way. But folks, they first come home. First of all, they need the transportation. They need housing. They need to be able to reintegrate with their families, and it's extremely difficult. And we're just not looking at the models that are sufficient to not only deal with the numbers, but to deal with it in a way that's holistic, mm-hmm. healing, and to reintegrate a person smoothly. At the Center for Returning Citizens, we talk about transformation and transition. The transformative process is not really given enough importance. It should start while a person is incarcerated, but there needs to be a smooth transition back into society.
Well, let me pick up on that. And Brandon was telling us a little bit about his life. And to you, John Day, as I mentioned in my introduction, I think it's just important for people to understand that our guests, you know, are speaking from their own experience. You spent 18 years in prison for bank robbery. Were you in any way rehabilitated when you served your time?
Well, when I talk about rehabilitation, the system doesn't rehabilitate. That's the first thing that your listeners need to realize, that the folks who are in prison, who transform themselves, there are some programs in place, educational programs, but for the most part, people get to a point in their life where they say, my life isn't working, I'm doing many years, I'm away from my family, I need to change, I need to transform them myself. And so that happens as a process. In terms of the programs that are inside of prisons, they're insufficient. It's too many people, not enough programs, and it's a individual process. But for those who do transform themselves, those who are intent on coming home, then you come home after many decades inside and you can't find a job. You're shut out of the job market. Returning citizens are the only group in this country that can be actively discriminated against in terms of jobs. You can't say to a gay person, because you're gay or because you're black or because you're a woman, we won't hire you. But corporations and businesses routinely say, because you are ex-offender, formerly incarcerated, returning citizen, we will not hire you. That is not right. And you can't expect people to come home and do the right thing if they're shut out of basic needs.
Let me pick up on that. Yeah, let me pick up on that and also get Brandon back in on the conversation. Are you talking, John, about this ban the box? The president signed that looking at federal workers. But is that something that you're referring to there?
Yes, not only on a federal level, state and city. Ban the box is good because what it does is it gets a person into the door.
Right.
But we need to change the perception of what it means to be a returning citizen and what it means to come back into society and intent on doing the right thing, being a good citizen, being a great employee, reintegrating with your family, and changing your life and fitting back into your community.
let me, Brandon, get you back in on the conversation. And as I understand it, Ban the Box is really has to do with that first initial interview.
Yes.
And it's that in that first initial interview, the question about incarceration mm-hmm. is not brought up.
Yes, definitely. Well, in 2012, when I was with God's Love at Work Foundation, G-Law, vice president there, one of the things that we did, we worked with Councilwoman Donna Reed Miller as far as like that first initial push for that Ban the Box here to come through Philadelphia. And we were successful. But the main thing is, you know, like Brother John Dye said, is that, you know, it's like, you know, it gets a person to that interview phase, you know, where they actually have an opportunity to sell themselves, you know, before the application goes all the way to the back because it says, you know, they've been convicted as a felon. And I think it is one of those things where it's like, you know, if we work a little bit harder at it, then we can unlock some more opportunity, you know, for our folks and especially our folks coming out of prisons.
John, did you feel like you had skills, marketable skills when you were released from prison?
Of course. I achieved my associate's degree while I was inside. I literally prepared for my freedom. I started 16 years out preparing for my freedom. And so many people acquire skills when they're inside or they already possess skills, and they are ready to move forward. Ban the Box is a start, but it's really insufficient. What we really need is a special status, a protective clause, because as returning citizens, we are a vulnerable class. In 2014, Mayor Nutter changed the designation in the city of Philadelphia from formerly incarcerated ex-offender to returning citizens. Mm-hmm. And in his language, he stated that as a class of people, we needed to be designated in a certain way. Well, that needs to be taken further. As a discriminated class, programs need to be put in place that could really deal with reentry. You know what I think about when I think about this situation is FDR in the 1930s and the WPA program. When at the height of the Depression and high unemployment, laws were passed that created jobs for a special class of unemployed people. This is how we need to think in terms of returning citizens as a special class and create programs that would directly impact. Let me give you an example.
Sure, go ahead.
In the city of Philadelphia, there are 44,000 vacant houses. Mm-hmm. They're trying to start a land bank. You could take those 44,000 houses. You're talking about an immense renovation program that would transform neighborhoods, employ returning citizens, and give them housing when those houses are done.
That's right.
Right now, if your family's on public housing and you come home, you can't live with them. You have to establish residence somewhere else.
That's right.
These houses could be rehabilitated by returning citizens, for returning citizens, and for other community members. And this would be an immense program for good that can not only revitalize city neighborhoods,
that's right,
but employ people and transform lives.
Connecting the dots, Brandon.
Yes, definitely. Well, like I say, I definitely agree. I mean, that's something that I would definitely, love to continue to do some work with Brother John Dye on because that's just it's just it. You know, you have to have something there to, you know, fill that void, you know, for these individuals coming out and trying to reenter into society. And if they have no place to lay their head, that's when all turmoil is lost. Like there's, you know what I mean? That they have to have that. And that piece, if, you know, it's just hard because like a lot of the money that comes in for reentry, you know, especially here in Philadelphia, a lot of it goes towards, you know, their programming. A lot of it goes towards their, drug and alcohol abuse. And, you know, those things are good. Don't get me wrong.
And needed, probably.
Definitely. And needed. But the main thing, when it comes to bringing those families back together, getting those structures back together, there's not much for that. You know, and that's why I appreciate the Center for Returning Citizens because they're actually one of the key organizations here in Philadelphia who gets the hand on the pulse of that work and they continue to scratch at it until they see some kind of, resistance.
And John, I'm picking up your group is called the Center for Returning Citizens. So language matters. You don't like the word what, ex-convict, ex-con, ex-prisoner? Is that still too loaded?
Listen, language is essential. How you define yourself is how you are perceived by the world and also how you view yourself. All those ex-terms, ex-offender, right, ex-con, formerly incarcerated, speaks to the past, speaks to the persons who we used to be. We're dealing in the present and moving toward the future. So we picked a positive designation that moves us forward as a class. I can't reiterate enough that this is a class problem. For those in the audience who have read Michelle Alexander's wonderful book, The New Jim Crow,
absolutely,
she talks about how mass incarceration has designated an entire generation of ex-offenders as second-class citizens. Well, we refuse to be second-class citizens. We're returning citizens home to reclaim our proper place in society. All we're asking for is a chance to move that forward.
Brandon, that's interesting. Yes. And what he said, it sort of picks up on what you were saying earlier about how you view yourself.
Yes, ma'am.
Once you're released from prison, do you see yourself as a returning citizen or do you see yourself as a ex-convict, ex-prisoner?
Well, I mean, they would like us to believe, you know, that we're ex-cons, you know, that we're animals. We're still, you know, we're still missing some element, some humanized element before we can actually say we're a citizen, you know. But me personally, I've actually looked at myself as a citizen coming back into society, and I made some mistakes, and now it's time to actually right a lot of these wrongs.
And that's Brandon Jones joining us in this hour of Radio Times. John Dye-Harrell with us as well. And we are talking about what to do about recidivism, what rights returning citizens have after they have been released from prison. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You can send us an email, radiotimes@whyy.org. And you can tweet us at WHYY Radio Times. Much more to talk about after this very short break. Stay with us. We'll be right back. This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen. We are focusing on reentry programs that reduce the prison recidivism rate, also working to prevent crime in the first place. And let me reintroduce our guest. Joining us by telephone is John Dye-Harrell, founder and executive director of the Center for Returning Citizens in Philadelphia. Also with us, Brandon T. Jones, founder and executive director of the New Generation Foundation. Also, that organization has started something called the Philadelphia International Youth Peace Movement, and he works with young people in the city to reduce violence and prevent crime. And John Dye-Harrell working with people who have served time in prison. And we got a lot of people that want to join the conversation. Let me get, looks like Anonymous to join us on Radio Times. Go ahead, you're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
I'm a 63-year-old white male that the worst I ever had was a speeding ticket 10 years ago. I was charged with a misdemeanor, simple assault, and had lost my job last year, making $80,000 plus.
Wow.
I have applied to 60 separate companies. And one of the first questions, have you ever been convicted of a felony or a misdemeanor? At the time, I hadn't been. It was a pending charge, yet I was being declined based on that pending charge. The other thing these guys need, and I don't use that derogatorily because now I feel for them, even not being in prison for any length of time, is a computer and clothing. And good luck getting an interview. I've had two interviews out of 60 applications.
Wow.
I'm highly trained in my profession, and it's very discouraging, and I am not surprised now, having been in a very minor similar situation, that these gentlemen go back and do what they used to do. Well, I'm not surprised at all.
I appreciate it.
And I feel sorry for them.
Well, I'm glad you called into the show. And John Dye, anything you want to say back to our caller?
Yes. That's our problem. It's extremely difficult to find employment with a felony or a misdemeanor on your record. That's why Band of Box is so important in terms of getting a person into the door so the human services personnel can see you as a real person. One of the things that we're really working on at TCRC is changing the perception of what it is, what a returning citizen is. We're normal people, regular individuals who have made a mistake, and we're trying to move forward in society. And the stigma of being formerly incarcerated ex-offender is really, really difficult. Mm. Listeners should really understand what it means for this man who has just a minor crime to be ostracized and not be able to get gainful employment. On the terms of employment,
let me read a
comment.
Yeah, no, go ahead. Sorry, go ahead.
Yes, the fiduciary of the TCRC is Goodwill Industries of Southern New Jersey and Philadelphia. Mark Boyd, the CEO, has this wonderful plan called Tax-Free Philly, where he believes that the city council and city government should offer tax-free status to manufacturers who will bring industry to Philadelphia. Hmm. Philadelphia is too caught up in the edge and meds type economy. Most of our folks do not fit into that mold. Mm-hmm. We need manufacturing. All through Philadelphia, there's what we call ghost factories, mm-hmm. factories that used to be in operation and are no longer. We need to look at raising these buildings to the ground and inviting manufacturers to come in as a stack-free status so that we can employ not only returning citizens, but our young in the community who do not have jobs, who have no prospects, who are not going to college, but right. need employment to keep them off the corner and in a gainful occupation.
Johnny, let me just jump in here. I want to give you're nodding your head, Brandon. Anything you want to add to that?
Well, basically, the only thing I really would add, you know, because he, you know, John Dye basically was covering, you know, the basis there, man, because that's important. And again, I always have to reiterate on the mindset. You know, if there's no programming, if there's, you know, like us, a new generation, we move away from really the word programming. You know, our thing is really, it's just
the
outreach.
Word
yeah, we don't even use the word in none of our proposals or anything. You know, it's just not, you know, for us, we're trying to rethink the idea. So basically, it's like that mindset. You know, if nobody's catering to the mindset of these individuals and how they're going to survive in a new way of life, a new way of living outside of the life of crime, and these behaviors, these learned behaviors that they picked up along the years, then, you know, you can put them in a brand new house, you can put them in a brand new, you know, job and everything, but they're still going to fail. You know, if their mindset is not worked on. And that's what some of this money and resources needs to be spent on.
Let me read a comment from Therese. Says there seems to be more opportunities for women versus men in terms of reintegration. A lot of men lack support systems, and I really believe that a support system is paramount for successful reentry. Most people want to do the right thing, and usually the first time they're jailed, it's for a minor offense. You agree with that, Brandon?
Yes, I do agree, you know, because that minor offense is what opens the door. You know, it's kind of like drug addiction, you know, like they say, oh, but marijuana could be the scapegoat drug, you know, now you're all blown out on all these other things. But that's kind of how it is. You know, you get that slap on the wrist. Oh, that wasn't that bad. No, I can do a few more things and, you know, see what happens and see if the outcome weighs, you know, either good or bad. But at the end of the day, you know, it's all still going to follow you.
Let me get Carolyn from looks like Chester Springs to join us. Hi, Carolyn. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, hi. I'm probably going to rain on your parade here, but the man who called in and couldn't get an interview may be different from the people that you're talking about here. I myself am afraid to work alongside someone who's a convicted rapist, murderer, or armed robber, and I don't know how you would feel there at WHYY working next to someone like that. I see my safety being put at risk to save someone who very well may hurt me. And I think these offenders, who very likely come from horrible home situations, need something like discipline, a work ethic, because they don't get it from home, and some kind of sensitivity training as to what they did to other people. And I think that we could have that in the military, maybe a special branch of the military, to give them the kind of skills that they need. Because they're not going to get it very likely just by chance after they leave.
Sure, Carolyn. I mean, what we're hearing from our two guests here is that they actually got some of that stuff that you're talking about, some of those skills, while they were in prison. Of course, that's not true for everybody. But let me give John Dye a chance to respond. She's saying she'd be afraid to work next to you, John Dye.
Well, I'm sorry to hear that, you know, but that is a common attitude. I think that what she's talking about, skills, at the Center for 20 Citizens, we teach critical thinking, time management, social responsibility. You know, what is your place in society? We teach ethics. These are many of the principles that young black men and women have not learned growing up due to many reasons. So many people think that as formerly incarcerated people, we are monsters. We're all rapists, child molesters. That's not the case.
That's right.
You know, that's why I say that the perception of who a returning citizen really is needs to be more fully brought to the light. We are everyday ordinary people who have made a mistake and are not seeking to harm a person at the workplace. What we teach our people is when you go to a job interview, you have to impress upon an employer that you will be the best possible employee that they could bring to the workplace. You'd be on time every day, you would fit well into the social life, and that you have the soft skills necessary to smoothly integrate into the marketplace, and that's what we teach.
Right.
Something Brandon said a little earlier about the money for reentry not flowing in the right direction. Here's the reality. Organizations like ours that are on the street level grassroots do not get the funding necessary to do the things we need to do on a larger level.
Right.
Funding goes in other directions. If we really want to attack mass incarceration, reentry, and transition, we have to fund those who have been through the situation, who understand it on an intimate level and are working hard to transform people and transition them back into society in the proper way.
And let me
this young lady wouldn't be afraid to work next to us because we'd be a shining example of what returning citizens really are.
Let me put the issue of police and law enforcement on the table.
Yes.
We haven't really talked about this, but to you, Brandon, mm-hmm. how do you see the relationship, a positive relationship that can be developed between the police and the people that they police, frankly?
Well,
especially in Philadelphia.
Well, especially here in Philadelphia. I mean, the lights are some of the things that have been going on around the country. I mean, we've been seeing it, you know, in spurts. You know, it's not nothing that's new. It's been happening, you know, for years and years, for generations. But now it's at the point where it's in the forefront again. You know, we have some powerful people, you know, in offices and in certain positions. And now they want to say, hey, we need to shed a light on this. And here in Philadelphia, I mean, one thing we've been doing in the new generation is that, you know, we've been holding these police sensitivity trainings in the community.
For the police?
Yes, for the police and the community. We've been doing it here in the 22nd District. We're trying to get, you know, a better hold on it, you know, with our police department. But now it's to a point where you actually have to go and reintroduce these police officers to the neighborhoods, especially these poverty-stricken neighborhoods, because that's where a lot of the problem lies. Mm. You know, I don't see it much in the suburbs, but I definitely see it in the inner city. And, you know, what we're doing is basically just saying, hey, you know, we'll put a few officers up here on a stage and we put a few young men. We'll give them a few different scenarios that they can actually act out to learn from one another, to actually have
like
a hands-on.
Yeah,
yeah, role play, a hands-on experience on what it's like to be in each other's shoes. And not only that, a real hands-on experience to know how can I rethink these situations if I come up with one of these, you know, negative, could possibly be negative situations in the near future.
John, now you want to weigh in on that, talking about the police relationship with the community?
Yes, I think that we need to get the police out of the patrol cars and onto the street. We need to have them walking beats in the neighborhood, getting to know people, establishing relationships. That's how you establish better community relationships, by getting out into the community, learning the folks in the neighborhood, dealing with us on a everyday basis. There's a human factor that we don't give enough credit to. Many times the police in Philadelphia and in other cities are looked on as a occupying force. But that also goes to the fact that we do have higher crime in black neighborhoods. But what is the reason for that? Mm-hmm. Why are there higher crimes? Lack of opportunity, lack of education, lack of entrepreneurship, and a black market economy. We have to look at these sources. We talk about the problems between the police and the community. Look at the problems in the community. That's where the fix has to be. If you fix those problems, there'll be less crime and better police relations.
And Brandon, I mean, it's true in Philadelphia. It's true in a lot of other cities that just crime-wise, that black-on-black crime is the driver in this city.
Yes, yes. You know, well, black-on-black crime as well, but just youth violence, man, and the whole aspect of it, you know, because it comes from so many different angles, so many different variables, but it all ends up with another young person, you know, losing their life, which I think is sad. And I think that it can be changed, but it's going to take a collective. Like they always say, it takes a village to raise a child, you know. So, you know, this is nothing that's going to just, there's no quick fix to this. You know, there's no quick reel in this is the solution and this is going to save us. You know, it's going to take a renewing of our minds and it's going to take some actual application of all of these beautiful things that we've learned along the way of what does work for us and what doesn't work for us. You know, it's going to take a collective.
But you're saying we know what works.
Oh, yeah, we definitely know what works. We know what works. Yeah. But now, the powers that be, they have to sit back and humble themselves and make some decisions that's going to affect the many, you know, in a more positive way, because everything that they've been doing from different administrations and down has just always been, you know, some setbacks in those areas.
Let me get one more caller in. This is John from Lawrence. John, we're almost out of time, but go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Yeah, my question is that there is a popular opinion that guns are easily accessible in urban communities. It's no accident that they are manufactured and marketed and focused on through underground means to be available in those communities. Is that any reality to that? I'd like a comment on that.
All right. We're almost, John Dye, do you want to weigh in on that at all? Have you thought about that?
Yes. We're talking again about the outward effects. Yes, there are guns in our community. Yes, there is crime in our community. We don't manufacture guns. You know, we don't import drugs.
That's right.
But they are readily available in our community because that is how society is structured. A minute ago you said, Marty, we know what works. But do we really know what works? Have we really tried what works? Think about this for a second. You have tens of thousands of returning citizens who have come home or are back in their community who could be role models to young people. They call us OGs. We're respected in our community. If the city would employ these returning citizens, assign them their neighborhoods, to train them in conflict resolution, and assign them to churches, community centers, neighborhood centers, we could attack the problem of youth violence in our city and cut it by 70% to 80%. It's simply a matter of looking at what would really work.
Well, we have to end.
Jim Kinney's.
I hate to do this to you, John, only because we are out of time, and I appreciate the fact that you were able to join us by telephone. John Dye Harrell, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
He's founder and executive director of the Center for Returning Citizens. Brandon Jones, thank you for joining us on Radio Times as well.
Thank you for having me. Appreciate the opportunity.
Absolutely. And he's founder and executive director of the New Generation Foundation. And that group has started another group called the Philadelphia International Youth Peace Movement. Go to WHYY.org/Radio Times. You can find out much more about the program. You can download a podcast of the show, find us on Facebook, and follow us on Twitter. I'm Marty Moscowain. Thank you so much for joining us in this first hour of Radio Times. And do stay with us. We've got hour two right ahead. Stay with us. We'll be back.